You are tuned in to a fireside chat with Zany Mystic. Join us now on another exciting metaphysical journey. Relax, tune in, drop out, and take a seat by the fire as we explore new realms and possibilities. This is Magenta Pixie. You can find me at magentapixie.weebly.com. But now, here is Zany Mystic and guest. Enjoy the show.
Greetings, and welcome to a fireside chat with Zany Mystic. I'm your host, Lance White. Today, my guest is Theodore Richards, Ph.D. Theodore is a poet, writer, and religious philosopher. He is a longtime student of the Taoist martial art of Bagua and Hatha Yoga, and has traveled, worked, and studied in 25 different countries. Theodore has received degrees from the University of Chicago, the California Institute of Integral Studies, Wisdom University, and the New Seminary, where he was ordained. He has worked with inner-city youth on the south side of Chicago, Harlem, the South Bronx, and Oakland, where he was the director of Yellowway, I hope I said that right, an innovative program for teens in Oakland created by Matthew Fox, which teaches philosophy, cosmology, and martial arts with a particular emphasis on creativity and imagination. He is the author of Handprints on the Womb, a collection of poetry, and his most recent book, Cosmosophia, or Cosmosophia, depending on your pronunciation, which we'll be delving in today. So let's welcome Theodore to the show now. Hi, Theodore. How are you?
Hi, Lance. Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Good, good. Well, before we delve too far into your book, Cosmosophia, how do you pronounce it, Sophia or Sophia?
Sophia.
Sophia, okay. I'd like to know a little bit more about what inspired you to immerse yourself in so many spiritual disciplines and also what you discovered in your travels.
Yeah, sure. I guess I should start with, I always, even as a small child, had some interest in these kinds of things. My grandfather and great-grandfather were Baptist ministers.
Oh.
And although I'm certainly no Baptist, I was influenced particularly by my grandfather, who always had a great deal of humor that he brought to things, and openness as well. So I think that was passed on to me. And I think you mentioned my travels. I've spent a great deal of time, and even before I left the United States, I was exposed to a lot of people from different backgrounds, and was always interested in meeting different kinds of people and that kind of thing. And of course, spending years in different countries, different cultures has sort of opened me up to a lot of different ideas.
You know, that's something that I always wanted to do, and I kind of have had to be an armchair traveler. So I do appreciate those people who have the courage to venture out and actually meet people from other other countries, which, you know, I think you might say that we speak the same language when we speak the language of love.
I would certainly agree with that. And I think that's really kind of where I started, you know, in my own kind of my personal spirituality was really where I was at before I did any kind of serious study. I think that was kind of where I was coming from. Moments when one is in a country where you can't speak the language, it really sort of challenges you. Right, you know, it tears away a lot of kind of the common assumptions that we sort of rest on most of the time. I can recall moments, for example, I was just thinking this morning actually about a time when I was in the back of a truck in Mozambique and people sharing fruit with me, or a time near the border of Iran and Pakistan many years ago, and people sharing tea with me, sitting around a fire, and just sort of the generosity and warmth with which I was treated by so many different people in so many different places. It is certainly a language that we can all understand.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, it seems that we've kind of lost our ability to tell our story, or to tell stories, which are metaphors and archetypes for the spiritual path. You know, sitting around by the fire and sharing, you know, where the grandfather, or the elder, or the shaman would share those stories. We seem to be disconnected from that that ability these days. We seem to get our stories from television and radio.
Yeah, that's you've really touched on, I think, for me, what's kind of like, you know, maybe, you know, one of the central challenges of the modern industrial world. It's that what it means to be a human, I think, and you can say a lot of different things about this, but one way to describe what it really means to be a human is that we are the creatures that sit around fires and tell stories to one another. And mm-hmm. in a lot of ways, we are a collection of stories. And mm-hmm. Losing that capacity or we so want, you know, that's the power of television in a lot of ways. It's so sort of seductive because it draws us in with stories. And, you know, maybe the same thing happens with kind of a lot of the celebrity stuff too, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But we've sort of become passive consumers of stories rather than active storytellers.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, as Thomas Berry says, we are in need of a good story more than anything else.
Mm, absolutely. And a lot of the mystery has been taken out of life, it seems as well, which your book attempts to recapture, revivify, which I loved your book, by the way. I can tell what your intention was from reading it, but what would you say your intent was in writing Cosmosophia?
Well, I think, you know, I mean, a few different things. I mean, I think one of the things is to sort of take a look at modern industrial society and say, you know, we're in crisis right now.
Mm-hmm.
We've reached...
Mm-hmm.
On a lot of different levels, we've reached an apocalyptic moment, which is a moment at which old ways of knowing, old ways of understanding who we are have come to an end.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, we're entering into a new way of being, and something's emerging in the universe. And that's going to, the form it takes for human beings is the form of a story, and that's how we convey that. That's this sort of, this way of relating to the world and way of understanding who we are is always been in human beings related through myth. I mean, the problem we have isn't that we don't have enough information. I mean, if we look at, you know, just to pick maybe the most obvious crisis that we find ourselves in, the ecological crisis. The problem is not that we don't have information, right? We have lots of information. You know, we're all sort of online all the time. We carry around phones that connect us to all sorts of information. In fact, you could say we're saturated with information. That's too much information. We can't
right.
process it. We can't
right.
integrate it. So the way that we, the decisions we make then are not decisions based on sort of rational looking at statistics and facts and information. The decisions we make are based on our sense of who we are and how we relate to the world, and that's very much conveyed through myth. And myth can be looked at in a lot of ways. I think, you know, you mentioned sort of how we've lost that capacity in the modern world, and even if we think about the way we think of the word myth, the first thing that comes up when we say myth for most people is that it's a lie, right?
Yeah,
it's untrue.
Yes.
And I think the real truth of a myth is far deeper than facts.
Yes, absolutely. And the other problem that I connect with when you're mentioning information and too much of it. We're getting too much of the wrong kind of information, which is misinformation, and we're not getting enough of the truth. Do you see that
happening
as well?
That's absolutely true. That's absolutely true. And it has a lot to do with, I think, with the way that information is framed and the way that the kind of myths that people are already operating out of, right? I mean, because
right.
I'm sort of trying to reclaim the word myth, but there are myths that are, you know, that are... That are helping us to live more sustainably, more loving, more connected, and there are myths that are about disconnection, about sort of that leave us alone. And if we are operating, because every bit of information we get is then sort of integrated, right, into some sort of core myth that each of us has. And if we're operating out of the wrong myth, then misinformation is very easily integrated into that myth. You know what I mean? So in order to even know what information is useful and what information is as you said, actually misinformation, it really depends on the core metaphors that we're operating out of. What are the basic assumptions that we're starting from? It becomes extremely difficult to process information without having the basic kind of myth to the basic kind of metaphors to integrate it.
Well, of course, anybody can understand the rape and pillage of the planet, whether we believe that she's alive or not. I tend to believe that she is, and that we're interacting with her, and that everything is a self-correcting and mirroring device. But it seems that people are completely disconnected, not completely, but almost completely disconnected from the source of their food and from the numerous ecological disasters that are reaching a tipping point.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, food is a great example. I mean, I'm glad you brought up food. It's not something I talk much about in the book, if at all, but I think that food really is a kind of core way that any person, that sort of reflects a person's basic values and the basic mythos out of which an individual operates is how we think of our food. And we sort of think of our food in a very... Well, we have, factory farming, I think, is problematic in itself, but it's also problematic in that it's based upon a myth that the universe is a machine, right?
Yes.
And that each of us can be kind of fragmented from the source of our food, that we're not... one of the things I do when I work with groups is I sit down and have people really reflect on and even write down all of the kind of... What had to happen in order for you to get your food? Like, what was the processes? What were the processes that happened? What was the sort of cosmic conspiracy that went into this food being in front of you right here at this moment? You know, if you take a single strawberry, it could take you, hours to really come up with all of the different factors that came into it. I mean, everything from the soil to the sun to the rain to the people who picked it and there's so many different ecological and social implications of that consciousness, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's really about changing one's consciousness from the consciousness of this isolated ego that's separate from everyone else to a consciousness of interconnection.
Oh, absolutely. And that's one of the biggest snafus that I see happening today is that we're it's really a spiritual malady. And in your book, you point out that original divinity is non-dual, yet we've managed to commercialize and fragment into competing and warring religions. And that seems to be a problem that needs to be solved as well so that we can understand that we are all interconnected. And the process of breaking bread with our neighbors and our families is a very important process, not just driving through a hamburger window to get our meal because we don't have time to eat anymore. That's kind of a living spiritual death. Would you like to elaborate on that or not?
Yeah, I mean, no, I think you said it pretty well. I mean, I think that the notion somehow. I think one of the issues we have with modern religion and the way I refer to it in the book is the psychologizing of religion. It's shrinking in shrinking ourselves down to this sort of whatever's going on inside our skulls. Mm-hmm. We've shrunken religion down, too, in a lot of ways. We think of it only as kind of psychological categories rather than the whole universe being part of a spiritual reality. So it's that has to do with our food, right? I mean, it's seldom, and people sometimes pray before they eat, but are they really thinking of the food, their food, and the sources of their food and all of the things that happen to get their food and the process of eating and sharing, are they really thinking of that? Are they really experiencing that as something that's spiritual? And I think a lot of the time, most of the time, people are not. And you can see the consequences.
Yes.
You know, you can't have something like the factory farm without that kind of consciousness first.
Yes.
And it's very hard to get rid of the factory farm, right?
Yeah.
When that is the consciousness that's starting with, you know, people sort of have trouble seeing why that's a problem.
Yes. Well, the most obvious one being dead earth, that the earth should be filled with microorganisms and nutrients, and it's been farmed to death, literally, so the soil is dead.
Yeah.
Then you have genetically modified food, which has a tendency to disrupt the organs of rats and mice in a very unpleasant manner, and we don't know what it's doing to humans yet, but that nobody seems to be concerned about that, at least not enough people to raise a red flag.
Yeah, and it's interesting, you know, you sort of started this part of the conversation in referring to the earth, whether, you know, the earth being living as opposed to being sort of, you know, a resource, right?
Yes.
And I think really when you begin with the assumption that the earth is not alive, that it's not that it's not sacred, you know,
right.
There's a lot of different ways you can put it, right? I mean, so you
right.
can put a lot of different language around it, but if you start with the assumption that the earth is simply just a resource, right?
Mm-hmm.
And its only value is just as a resource, then so you're sort of starting with the earth being dead in your assumption, and then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? You
mm-hmm.
do end up with dead earth, right? Because all of the practices that arise out of that initial kind of assumption
mm-hmm.
lead to actually destroying some of the living ecology of the planet.
Absolutely, and the corporations are quick to convince us that everything they're doing is above board and not harmful. So we're getting kind of brainwashed into believing and lulled into believing that everything's okay, but it's not. I would go further to say that there's a disconnect between the left and right brains, and that we're mainly living from the left side, which is the linear side that
right.
is not intuitive.
I agree with that. I mean, a couple of things you mentioned. I mean, one is that, you know, mentioning corporations, and when we think about, you know, if we buy into the idea, which I'm sort of proposing here, that our actions ultimately can be rooted in whatever kind of mythology we have, right?
Mm-hmm.
The myths we have today are largely given to us by those corporations, right? I mean, who's controlling the commercials we see on television? And you know,
right.
how many hours do most of our children spend in front of a television?
Right.
You know, it's a lot. I don't have the number in front of me, but it's the mind-boggling number of commercials, for example, that a kid sees before they turn 5 years old, right?
Oh, absolutely. And geared towards that age.
So that's, you know, that's kind of the first you know, the very beginning of the problem right there.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's been figured out probably to a person how to indoctrinate the human being so that they'll socialize quickly and buy this brand and that brand. By the time they grow up, there will only be one corporation. It'll be like the cartoon where it's just Acme Corporation.
Right.
And then
right.
your choice has gone out the window, and you really are a slave, only you don't realize it.
Yeah. Well, that's an easier form of control, I suppose, than actually like beating people up about it, you know?
Right.
The other thing I want to respond to was when you mentioned the left and the right brain, and very much one of the things I do in the book, as you know, is I sort of trace kind of the history of ideas that gives rise to this kind of like really profound absence of the kind of the right brain with the intuitive and the creative part, you know, as Western industrial society has become, particularly in the Enlightenment, but it can be traced back before that. Particularly with the Enlightenment, there's been sort of a stronger and stronger bias toward the rational. Right,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And everything else has been sort of repressed and pushed away. And with this increased emphasis on the rational or the logical, we've repressed the mythological or the intuitive. And as a result, we're sort of unaware that we're living in what really is a mythic world. It's a world we put together through story, and it's a world in which rational thought has its place, but we delude ourselves when we think that we are always being rational. You know, I think Western industrial society is perhaps, and this is always done in any culture to some extent, but we're particularly good at pretending as though we make rational decisions. In other, you know, in other kind of cultures and in other times in human history, people were just sort of, you know, irrational, right, and superstitious and that kind of thing. But
right.
I think we've we've diluted in repressing that side of the brain, we've really diluted ourselves, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we're increasingly unable to come up with the imaginative kinds of ways of looking at the world that we really need at this moment, you know, because a big part of that process of reclaiming our interconnection and our sense of that is really intuitive. One has to feel it. It can't just
mm-hmm.
be intellectualized completely.
Mm, absolutely. And you know, it seems irrational to kill other people for any reason whatsoever. To demonize other cultures as if they're evil and wicked when they have wonderful, rich, cultural, spiritual heritages to share with us. And I hate to say this, but the United States has been doing this empire building for so long now that it seems like an octopus that's out of control. And, you know, we're running into other countries and doing things subterraneously that are really quite devious and contra-intuitive. And then we're fed all these war stories. Look at Battle of L.A. just came out about
right.
aliens now. Now the aliens are the enemy. So I suppose that's going to be the next big push. You know, all of this justification and demonization of other cultures is really a wrong. My aunt came from Iran, and she had her family were on the higher level of the spiritual sphere, and she's a wonderful person. And you've traveled throughout the country, so you know that. That what we're saying and doing and demonizing other cultures is really an excuse to justify interfering in their economy for
yeah.
our own gain.
Absolutely. I mean, I think imperialism, much like one of the things I try to do in the book is explain how a phenomenon like imperialism and this kind of plundering of the planet that we do, and you know, sexism, racism, various other ways in which, you know, people do really kind of, as you put it, irrational things, right?
Mm.
Those things are at a profound level really connected to one another. These are ways of othering,
mm-hmm.
whether
mm-hmm.
it's the earth or other people or, you know, countries, that kind of thing. I mean, yeah, as you put it, I mean. Sure, I've been to Iran myself, and you know, it's an incredibly it's a beautiful place. It's a welcoming, generous place. I mean, people. I can recall, you know, being on a bus that broke down as I first arrived in Iran, and when we were stopped by the border security, and the guy asked me where I was from, and I said I was from America.
Hmm.
There was a lot of surprise. It was sort of like, you know, if you ever remember, there was these commercials a long time when I was a kid called, and here we go, commercials, right? We all know the same commercials. E.F. Hutton, and like they would say the word E.F. Hutton, and everyone would stop and turn around. It was kind of that kind of a moment when I said I was from America. Everyone, they didn't speak much English, but they knew when I said I was from America, so they were surprised to see an American. But everyone was nice to me. They gave me food. They helped me, you know, helped me find a hotel. I mean, it was incredible how generous and welcoming people were. It's very different from kind of the demonization that you see in the mainstream media of that
mm-hmm.
part of the world. And of course the other thing is, if you look at kind of some of the history of Islam, for example, it's an incredibly rich and nuanced
mm-hmm.
history there, from which we can certainly learn a lot. And it's sort of we get kind of a caricature of Islam in the media. That's,
right,
that's
right.
Unfortunate, right? And that's how war is always justified. I mean, how can you get someone to kill somebody they don't know, right? I mean, you have to kind of get them to buy into a story, don't you? It's amazing
yeah.
how powerful a story is. If you can get someone to buy into a story, you can get them to actually kill another human being they don't even know.
Yeah, absolutely. That gets back to your storytelling again. And unfortunately, it seems like the corrupt politicians and the corporations are telling the main stories that we're falling prey to. Some people feel that we're on a verge of a massive shift in consciousness or a birth, and you talk about giving birth a lot throughout the book. And what do you feel about that from your viewpoint? Do you feel like we're on the at a turning point, or I mean, obviously we are in ecologically and in many other ways spiritually. But how do you see the shift in consciousness and what's occurring today?
Well, I look at it, you know, and I use this metaphor that, you know, I wrote the book as my daughter, who's now three, as my daughter was in the womb and when she was born. So that metaphor was really kind of alive for me when I was writing the book.
Yeah.
So that was part of the reason why I chose it. But I think it really works. I mean, if at a kind of really basic level, it's an organic metaphor. You know, and there's a lot of different ways we can think of ourselves and what we are, but all the metaphors we work out of. I mean, if you just sort of pick up a newspaper and look at all the metaphors that are used, most of them are mechanistic ones, right? They're based on the industrial capitalist paradigm. And it's really, really hard to critique the industrial capitalist paradigm when those are the only metaphors you have. So you need different metaphors. The way I look at the universe and the way I'm sort of proposing we can start to put together a cosmology, I'm not claiming that I by myself am putting together an entirely new worldview
right.
or cosmology, but I am
right.
suggesting that we are at a moment at which a new one is coming forth, and it will be done collaboratively, and it will be done by all different levels of society. I think that there are points at which in the universe when something new emerges, like, and it's totally unexpected. We don't really know what it is. I mean, we have this thing called life emerges on planet Earth, and before that, as far as we know, there was nothing like it. I mean, it's entirely novel, and it emerges seemingly out of nothing. It's a total shift in the way the universe is expressing itself. It's not better, but it's entirely new. And I think in human beings, there's something new, too, that emerges. And as you look at human history over the course of time, new paradigms arise in time, and a lot of time it's because of a crisis point. If we retrace, we look at the apocalyptic, one of the things I've done a lot of is study the apocalyptic tradition, and if we look at different sort of apocalyptic traditions, they often arise in the context of crisis, and a crisis can be an ecological one, which we're experiencing now. You know, for example, when people first ventured out beyond Africa, it was because of a drought in Africa precipitated by climate change, so that was... That was, so people are saying, let's move past Africa. And if we look at the flowering of human culture that happened after that great migration happens, it's amazing, you know. And then we look at, you know, and but there are also paradigm shifts that are kind of just cultural, right? I mean, we have, if you look at the word apocalyptic, which comes from, which is a Greek word, which means revelation, essentially, and it's the apocalyptic tradition starts, at least by that name, starts in the Hellenistic period when the Israelites were feeling the imposition of Hellenistic culture. This Greek culture was sort of coming down on their culture, and they were feeling as though they were being threatened. And there was this idea that somehow, very much like a shamanistic journey, that they could break, that what was going to happen is not just a shift in the political order, but a shift in the very nature of the cosmos, that this world, this universe, was going to come to an end. And that an entirely new way of looking at the world was going to arise. And the interesting thing about that is they weren't exactly right. The universe didn't end, we could say. We could say that, oh, they're just sort of silly, superstitious people. But actually, they were more right than they even knew. Because what actually was happening at that point in history was it wasn't just that a new universe wasn't being birthed just in a physical sense, but it was being birthed in a spiritual sense, being birthed in a cultural sense, because of the mixing of the Near Eastern culture of the Israelites and the Hellenistic culture, an entirely new way of looking at the world was brought forth. And I would suggest that at this moment in human history, as we've sort of planetized ourselves, we have this kind of consciousness that we're now aware of ourselves as a planetary being. We don't actually have a cosmology or a worldview that really is able to grapple with that. You know, we're still kind of living in an older way of being. We're certainly at the very least living in a Newtonian universe, which doesn't really reflect all of the insights of science over the last 50 to 100 years. So faced with ecological crisis, faced with a crisis of human rights, faced with a crisis of meaning, most profoundly, I think. You know, people no longer, people are sort of have reached this, the edge. We hear about, people talk about eschatology, they're referring to reaching the edge of the universe. And that's really where we are. We're at the edge, not just of the physical universe, but of the spiritual universe that we've created for ourselves. And the only way to give birth to a new story, a new universe, is to tell a new story.
Absolutely. Beautifully said. It does seem like everything's been said and done already many times over, and we've reached the end of the line, so to speak. And I know Terrence McKenna used to talk about this period of time that's leading up towards about the 2012 period in being the increase in novelty, the absolute increase in novelty and in chaos at the same time.
Right.
So it's conceivable that we're at another moment or of evolutionary leap, which has inexplicably happened according to scientists. They don't understand yet how we evolved, you know, from one version of man to another. But we could be leaping into the next version, because we're really just on the cusp of it would seem, and our worldview is really rather antiquated and antediluvian. I mean, it just doesn't work anymore.
Right, right. Yeah, Thomas Berry refers to it as a dysfunctional cosmology.
Yeah, absolutely.
We don't have a cosmology that suits us, that fits the kind of fits our current situation. And it's less a problem of kind of absolute right and wrong. I think that, you know, worldviews change and evolve in time, just like life does. And you know, there's kind of a right time though for the birth of something new, for birth of novelty. And it seems as though this is such a moment.
Well, yes, and of course, I'm sure you're aware of the various prophecies that are coming to an end, and the Mayan calendar with its end date of 2012 or 2011, if you prefer Kara Kalman's view on that one.
Right.
And the numerous cosmic cycles that are coming to an end, the billions of year cycles that are, you know, all seem to be simultaneously going around the odometer to zero. So, and we're also tipping into the other side of the galactic plane, which is an area we've never traveled before in our memory or as far as we know. And that could be a whole new experience in terms of dimensions opening up and communications with other civilizations and who knows what else. With the divine. I'd be happy if we could just reconnect with the planets and the sun and the solar system and the universe and the divine again.
What I think it really comes down to, at least for me, others may have more insight on this than I have, but I think for me, and I'm comfortable with this, and I think, you know, kind of on a psychological level, this is sort of healthy to think this way, is that we really just don't know what's happening, do we? I mean, it's like,
right,
there's a lot of unknown out there.
Right.
And if you look at human civilization, a great deal of human civilization has been about this very encounter with the unknown, an encounter between civilization and the wilderness. And we spend so much time trying to sort of fend off the wilderness. You could kind of think about patriarchy in that way. In a lot of ways, it's been sort of a process that of paving over the wild. Right, of repressing the chaos, and there are kind of, you know, legitimately practical reasons people have done that. The problem is what it's culminated in, I think, at this point, and this is why we're really at a shifting point now, is that we've paved it over to such an extent that on one hand we've compromised our ability to actually survive, which is one problem. But even if we sort of, you know, aren't too bothered by that, I think what the real tragedy is that we've paved over the wildness in ourselves. And in that process, we've sort of, you know, impoverished our experience of life. You know, we're a little less alive, I think, in a paved over world than in a slightly wild one.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And maybe I know that the left brain is the part that wants answers, and when it has them, then there's no point in looking any further for the mystery.
Right. Right.
You know.
Yeah, it does. It has a lot to do, I think, as you with that kind of fragmentation, doesn't it? It's,
mm-hmm.
it's
mm-hmm.
we want order. We want something logical. We want something that we can you know, grasp and control, right? That is the left brain, right?
Mm-hmm.
And a little bit of that is okay. Some order, some control is fine and healthy and good. But too much of it can be a problem, and I think we're seeing both on a kind of cultural and psychological level, and also on a very ecological, physical level too. We're seeing the real problems with that.
Oh, absolutely. And I don't know where it was originally said, but the money is the root of all evil. It probably isn't too terribly far from the truth. You know, if we were on a resource-based economy rather than a monetary economy, then things would look a lot different. And
yeah, I think one. Yeah, I mean, certainly. Yeah, wherever it was said, I mean, certainly it's as you said, not far from the truth, right?
Mm-hmm.
One of the issues around it is that it's an abstraction, isn't it? So you think about when you think about things in terms of monetary value, right? When we think about things in terms of a quantifiable number we can put on something, it really it obscures, I think, a lot of other ways to think about value. One of the things I'm interested in is education and thinking about how we educate people and what does it really mean to be an educated person. There's so much debate about about education, but not a lot of really real nuanced discussion about what it actually means to be educated, because all of the discussion is around a kind of quantifiable number, right? Like a test score that makes a person educated. It's very similar, I think, when you think about the economy. I mean, the economy is an abstraction of some things that are very real and things that you can't actually put an exact number on, because if we think about what the world is comprised of, it's actually living beings, right? Everything that we're really buying and selling and trading, these are all living, and these are all part of ecosystems, and they're interconnected in highly complex ways and chaotic mm-hmm. ways that we don't actually completely understand. And to put simple monetary value on them is just sort of an abstraction, and it takes them out of their context
mm-hmm.
and it obscures what the real value might be, which isn't entirely quantifiable at all.
Right. It seems that we move out of the being organic beings that are interconnected to something that is lifeless, that is literally choking us to death with all of its machinations.
It really is. It really is. I mean, it's
we become,
you know,
enslaved, basically. We've become enslaved.
What's that?
We've become enslaved.
Yeah, no, I think we really have, we've become enslaved by a story that's not working in a lot of ways. I mean, it's a story that tells us, or you know, or at very least of a metaphor, the metaphor that the universe is a machine, and that the universe consists of various fragmented, disconnected parts,
mm-hmm.
rather than an organic whole. And the details of that are highly complex, and how to make that shift happen. But if we just look at that kind of core metaphor right there in the very beginning, that really is so many of our problems can be traced to that metaphor.
Well, you know, you mentioned that, and I was just recently reading a book, Not in His Image, and the Gnostics seemed to believe that there was an inorganic form of life, the Archons, that surreptitiously had some kind of viral control over the organic life. So it's not too far removed to think that there might be something operating beneath the surface that we're not actually aware of.
We have, there's a few different, yeah, I mean, there's definitely, there are definitely a lot of different ways to think about that. You know, I tend to look at, in my own sort of personal theological view is what I would describe as panentheistic, which is that there is something spiritual in everything, and at the same time there's also a transcendent. So that the divine for me is something that's beyond everything, and at the same time is also within everything in the universe.
Mm-hmm.
What exactly does that look like? how is something, what makes something sacred? What does that consist of? The best word that I have for it is imagination. And I think that if we look at, for example, we talked about Islam earlier in the Sufi tradition, there's this notion that Ibn Arabi had that everything in creation was not God, but it was a part of God, and it was a part of the divine imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And that the way we sacralize the world is through our own imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's this kind of twofold notion of imagination that Ibn Arabi in the Sufi tradition connects the kind of mundane world with the divine. And there are a lot of, you know, there's sort of a lot of ways of thinking about that. You know, and of course, if you look at the oldest human traditions, it's sort of, this is sort of a living world in which each human is not really separable from the ecosystem at all. You know,
mm-hmm.
that's, you know, very much everything becomes divine in that way of thinking. The problem
mm-hmm,
comes
right.
up when we start to think of a human world, or really a world that's just sort of in our own heads and then everything else. And, you know, Descartes is probably the key figure in that process, the French Enlightenment philosopher, who posits that there's sort of an isolated ego that's separate from everything else, and it really gets us kind of, and St. Augustine too, if you want to go a little further back, when thinking about the soul and the divine as being separate from everything else in creation, how do we then get back to the sense of the planet, of the universe, of each of us, of other people,
mm-hmm.
in fact, being imbued with some sort of sense of being sacred? How do we get back to that? I think it's a fundamental question for our species.
Oh, absolutely. Let me know if you have an answer to that one.
I have some suggestions, but an answer for that, I think, is I don't know that it's something that one person can come up with. You know,
I don't either. I've pondered this a lot, and I keep coming back to the idea that it might require some kind of influx of divine light that reconnects everything at the mystical and spiritual levels and awakens us to our divine selves. But, well, you know, whether that happens or not, that could be just my imagination.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, it does, it's this sort of, I mean, what does the imagination do? The imagination, you know, the imagination brings forth something that is not yet present,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, so, mm-hmm. and each of us, I mean, if we really think about what it means to have a soul, having this capacity to create that which isn't yet present, and as we said before, you know, the story, the this new story that I'm suggesting we need. I mean, Thomas Berry really is the one who proposes this first. It's not there yet, and it's not something that I can do. I mean, I'm as a poet, as a writer, I can participate in the process, but it's something that requires all of our poets, all of our writers, all of our painters, our musicians,
mm-hmm.
our philosophers, all kinds of different people to come up with
mm-hmm.
these new stories, right?
I mean, absolutely.
It's an imaginative thing. I mean, it's so kind of, and I suppose it's typical that a politician would say this kind of thing, but our politicians always, you know, sort of propose that we'll solve all of our problems through technology. And technology is useful. I'm not suggesting that no technology is good, but really what we need is the imagination much more than we need technology.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And technology is also becoming more invasive with the organic system of the human being. So, you know, there are all kinds of potentials for positive and destructive things to occur once we start taking various technological devices into our brains, or having microchips in our system, and so on and so forth. It seems like a rather ominous moment in terms of the technology that's available.
It does, and I think it's naive for us to think that you know, while I don't reject all technology, I mean, we're talking on the phone here. The phone is rather useful, right?
Right.
You know, that is a technology.
Right.
To accept without any question, though, everything new that comes up, and this is really where our culture is now, I think, is that everything is automatically assumed to be good and of value.
Yeah,
I think that's a, I think that's a, um, I think that's a dangerous way to proceed,
yes.
to say the least, as you're suggesting. I mean, I think that each technology is a bit of a Faustian bargain. I mean, I think it,
just
as it contributes to our lives, it also has the potential to distract us, to disconnect us. So there are a lot of problems with it. So I wouldn't reject all technology, but I would think we ought to maybe proceed with a little more kind of nuance and a little more thought about what really is of value. You know, technology is so connected with our capitalist with the capitalist paradigm that it's a little bit it's hard to separate the two, I think. And most of the driving force for new technology seems to be what will make money rather than what will give add value to our lives.
Absolutely. You know, I walk through some of these big box stores and it's just appalling to me how enormous they are and how filled they are with junk that's overpriced that we really don't need.
It can be a little well, it's good that you're still sensitive enough to respond that way. I mean, you're so desensitized, right? To that is kind of the norm. I mean, it's amazing to me always to go from a developing country in particular, and then come back and go to a store like that, or even one of these large grocery stores, and just see kind of the kind of bloated, over the top stores we have here. Yeah, with so much that we, like you said, that we don't need.
Absolutely. Right?
I think that one real solution, I think, or one real solution to the ecological crisis is to, on a psychic level, to kind of begin to live our lives as if we have enough, right?
Absolutely.
And if we can do that, we'll buy a lot less and destroy a lot less, right? We won't have to invade other countries to get their oil. We won't have to kind of plunder the earth for more resources, and I think on a basic level it starts, with recognizing that each of us is enough,
mm-hmm.
and if we're told constantly by advertising and these kinds of things that we're insufficient,
you're right.
Want more stuff,
That's right. Absolutely. Just that one shift alone would change the entire face of the planet if we each just made the commitment to knowing that what we have is enough, and that we don't need anything new, and we don't need anything more, better, or different.
Because it's a huge shift, but it really is kind of the core of so many of our troubles.
I did ask a long time ago in the 70s, and Werner Erhard said that one of the things that stood out was that we play this game of getting more, and then when that runs out, we need to get something better, and then we get something different. Sometimes we play all three at the same time.
Yeah.
And we can see how, becoming a millionaire used to be kind of a, having a mansion and a fancy car. Now it's a billionaire, and we know that there are trillionaires that, pretty much control the world now. So when is it enough? When does it become destructive to own countries and people, and when do you start making decisions for huge groups of people that are not necessarily in their best interest? Well, I think that's happening right now.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think it was Foucault who said that he hoped for a world in which no man had had enough to buy another, and that no man had so little that he had to sell himself to another.
Absolutely. I think the greatest thing that we can have, and I don't think I've ever had it, is our freedom. Total freedom with nobody controlling anyone else. And that perhaps that is a useful thought to consider as our next, jumping off point, that we've had enough of control systems, and let's try being free for once and working together and appreciating each other and seeing the divine in everything, like you said.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think this question of freedom, freedom is so such an abused word in our in our culture, isn't it? I mean, we talk about freedom, you know, in such skewed ways so often in the popular discourse. It's become absurd. You know, but I think, you know, freedom ultimately has to do with having the capacity to really understand one's choices in the first place.
Yes.
You know, so I think it's really think about them. It's really then, you know, have the capacity to experience the world and others in an authentic enough way to be able to make decisions then. You know, just sort of giving one the right to vote or in the absence of any kind of authentic education or authentic, you know, relationship is not a great deal of value.
Well, there's a lot of things that could be, we could, you know, mention would be useful in terms of education. I know you do a lot with the city kids, and I mean, that's a wonderful place to make a difference with people. And in terms of education, it seems like it would be great if there was some kind of a wilderness, what do you call it, where you go out into the wilderness and you have a spiritual experience.
No, it's funny you mention that, because I'm actually, as soon as I get off the phone with you, I'm actually leaving and taking a group of 10 kids from here in the south side of Chicago up to Michigan for a weekend retreat.
Oh, wow.
For their rite of passage, annual rite of passage.
Oh, yeah.
To do with them.
Wow, that is fantastic. See, I just created it and you're doing it.
There you go. You just thought of it and instantly.
Doesn't
always work that way. Yeah, that's what we're about to do, and we do, you know, the best part of it is that we do this star walk where we actually take them out at night and they get to see the stars, hope for a clear night. And they get to actually, for the first time, sometimes the first time in a long time, get to see the stars at night. And it's really a profound experience, and we tell stories about that. And ultimately what we're trying to do is say to them, look, you know, if you, no matter what you do with your life, you're responsible to tell your story. If you don't tell your story, someone else is going to.
Yes, yes. Yep.
And we all have something to learn from other people. You know, I mean, I think that people at the margins of a society sometimes have a wisdom that that those of us who have benefited from it don't have. You know, we can really learn from that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, that is wonderful to hear that you're doing that. And if people are interested in that kind of experience with you, how do they? Might as well find out how to get in touch with you right now.
Yeah. You can find me. You can find me on Facebook. You can also find me on my website, which is www.cosmosophia.org. That's CosmosOphia.org. If you're interested also in some of the work we're doing here in Chicago, education-wise, my organization is called the Chicago Wisdom Project, and our website is chicagowisdomproject.org.
Wow. I so admire what you're doing, Theodore. It's absolutely vital that people take the initiative to do the things that you're doing to reintroduce us to the mystery of life. And I know I live out in the country, so I have a pretty good view of the stars on some nights when the chemtrails aren't there. And there are some nights when it looks like an inverted bowl, and it's just awesome. And I know that you can't see that in the cities. That's something we miss.
And that's been a fundamental part of every human being's experience on the planet since, you know, except for the last really just blink of an eye that we've lost that, you know?
Yes. Yes, and now we're living in virtual worlds. You know, where people kill each other and get points for the most bodies.
Yeah, well, the screen has replaced that, and so much of what you get on the screen, well, the screen is two dimensions.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, I think that's a real kind of, that's a consciousness shift there that's really profound, and it's a warping, I think.
Yes, I think you're right. I've never heard it said that way, but we're moving out of being three-dimensional into two-dimensional, which is kind of not the wrong direction. It seems that the universe itself is moving us towards more dimensions, a greater experience, a vaster experience of ourselves that's not limited to our senses, and that's what you seem to be talking about in your book, which is so important. One thing I wanted to ask you about. You have a daughter that's three, and I've talked to people on the phone that have mentioned that the incoming soul has had conversations with the mother before impregnation, and I always thought that was a fascinating thing. And a lot of the kids that are coming in are just brilliant. They're indigos and crystals, and I'm sure you're aware of all of that.
Right.
Did your wife have any of those experiences where she spoke with the spirit of your daughter? You know, like what name would you like to have? And sometimes it's just very basic stuff.
Nothing is explicit as that. But I think that. You know, I certainly see in her just an incredible, I know a little bit about the indigo child phenomenon, enough to know that I think, you know, she probably exhibits a lot of those kinds of characteristics. I mean, I think that she really, she gives me hope that in spite of all the problems we have, that there's this, real possibility. With a new generation, if we don't kind of crush their spirit before they get the chance. The other side of it is that we're doing a good job of kind of crushing our kids' spirits before they're able to actually change anything. So, we have to kind of allow them that freedom of exploration that really is fundamental to what it means to be a human being.
Absolutely, and I was raised on television. I was born in 1950, but it wasn't quite so bad as the kids in the 60s and 70s, where they're just plopped down in front of a television or a Game Boy all day because the parents don't have time to really be with their children and to love them and to communicate. They talk down to the kids as if they're stupid. And I think you and I would both agree that the children are brilliant, and if you treat them as brilliant, they really shine.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Shine is the right word. Is the right word. So yeah, that's she in a lot of ways she has revealed to me that I am a poet. I think it's something.
Well, and of course, looking into the eyes, the mirrors of the soul, that always is a way that we can communicate with one another. And I think a lot of people are letting some of their shadow side up because a lot of that is what keeps us from looking each other in the eye. And so a lot of people are doing shadow work and looking deeper within and acknowledging and telling themselves the truth, which is very important to evolving to the next level.
Yeah, that's well said.
So, well, we have about a minute left. Is there anything you'd like to share with us before we have to sign off?
I'd just like to say, well, thank you to you. I really enjoyed the conversation. I hope people will, if there's anything that I'd like to suggest that people do, is they just slow down for a moment and kind of walk outside. And I can remember my daughter when she was very little, she would walk outside and she would stick her tongue out and taste the wind. So I suggest that everyone take some time to do something like that, to taste the wind and to really kind of experience the universe in a really kind of, in a deeper and more connected way. Yeah. And, and get involved, please feel free to contact me, look into what the Chicago Wisdom Project is doing. We're really looking to we're working with partners in different cities, including Oakland out on the West Coast, and trying to revolutionize education.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Theodore, for sharing your wisdom and your thoughts with us today, and for writing such a wonderful book, Cosmos Sophia. I just love what you're doing, and I thank you for being here in the world to make a difference.
Thanks to you, Lance.
Okay. All right. Well, take care, and thanks again for being here.
All right.
All right. Bye-bye.